clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Turkey has recalled its ambassador after Germany's parliament voted to recognize the Armenian genocide of 1915. Turkish President Erdogan has said that the vote will have, quote, serious consequences for the relations between Turkey and Germany and the EU. Will this resolution derail the EU-Turkey refugee deal? How does it impact Turkish President Erdogan's political status at home? Foreign ministers meet in Paris for talks aimed to resume the so-called peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians. But is this a road to peace or just a mirage? Nobel Peace Prize winner President Barack Obama addressed the graduating class of the Air Force Academy yesterday. Was Obama ever the, quote, peace candidate? Now in his final year in office, what is the true legacy of Barack Obama's military and foreign policy? But first we turn to Turkey and Germany. The German Bundestag, the parliament, has voted to recognize the Armenian genocide of 1915. The Turkish government immediately recalled its ambassador, and President Erdogan said that Turkey would retaliate. Why did Germany do this? Why did it do it now? What's Turkey likely to do in response? And what will its impact be on a possible refugee agreement between Turkey and the EU? We are joined by William Whiteman from Berlin. Welcome back, William.
Glad to be back.
So Turkey has recalled its ambassador after the German parliament's vote. So talk about the big picture. Why did the German parliament do it? Were they expected to do it? Was this Merkel? Was this opposition parties? And what will its impact be on Turkish-German relations?
Well, I mean, obviously, you have to take into consideration the fact that given the weight of the Holocaust during the Second World War on the German psyche, anything like this, any kind of genocide or injustice, generally, people have a huge amount of sympathy towards. So this vote to recognize the Armenian genocide, obviously, it's 101 years later, but this has been in the making for over a year now. However, given the sort of the volatility of the situation at the moment with the refugee crisis and the recently brokered so-called migrant deal that was struck between the EU and Turkey, Merkel can certainly seem to have been doing some sort of logistical maneuvering to try and avoid the vote happening, because this is an incredibly sensitive issue for Turkey. They have always reacted incredibly violently to, in terms of their rhetoric, to anyone who moves to recognize the Armenian genocide. So it has been a huge problem, I'm sure, for the Merkel administration. However, there has been a very, very big movement, a big force, particularly amongst leftist opposition parties such as Die Linke and the Green Party, for this vote to take place. So it had to happen eventually. It's happened now. But this could potentially, if the refugee crisis, the migrant deal, as it's called, if that were to collapse, this could potentially be very, very unpopular for Angela Merkel. And of course, she herself did not attend the vote. A spokesman of hers said that she had another event that she had to attend. And immediately afterwards, she made a statement very much stressing the diplomatic ties between Turkey and Germany, and really emphasizing the friendship between the two countries. So yeah, it is something which is very, very sensitive to Turkey. But then obviously, given the situation, given the fact of Germany's leadership of Europe and the so-called refugee crisis, is also a matter of sensitivity to the Merkel administration too.
So Merkel's popularity, her approval ratings have gone considerably down in the last year since the beginning of this crisis. I think Germany has accepted more than a million refugees. Their Merkel government positioned itself in the beginning as being welcoming, being sympathetic. But since then, there's been a backlash, a right-wing opposition perhaps, against the influx of refugees into Germany. Her approval rating has gone down. Talk about what the actual agreement is between the EU and Turkey, because the Turkish left party, I mean, the German left parties that were insisting on this vote going forward about recognizing the Armenian genocide, they're saying, well, Erdogan is trying to hold Germany and hold the EU hostage, playing blackmail games over the refugee crisis. Talk about what the agreement is and what do they mean by that?
Well, so the agreement is, I mean, I think everyone knows that this was a very big bit of political maneuvering by Europe. I mean, Angela Merkel has spearheaded this agreement with Turkey. But, I mean, human rights organizations have been outraged by it. Obviously, the whole principle behind it is that Syrian refugees who are within Turkey are traded for or Syrian and Iraqi and also Afghani refugees, people who are fleeing conflicts, who have managed to reach Turkey, are now being traded with people who are fleeing North Africa and the Middle East from countries where there are not conflicts raging. They're sort of supposed to be doing this switch. There's been a lot of reports saying that actually very, very few refugees have actually changed hands. Essentially, this is just a big plug in the flow of refugees and migrants who are attempting to cross over into Europe. Obviously, the thing which is making this into a bottleneck is the fact that the Balkan states have all closed their borders to refugees. So it is kind of the linchpin which is keeping the whole thing together. Initially, Angela Merkel welcomed refugees. There was an incredibly euphoric and positive attitude in Germany, as was widely reported on when refugees first started arriving. However, the right-wing press quickly mobilized to demonize what was deemed as an Islamization of Europe, and obviously seized upon various events which have happened over the past year, going back to the Cologne rape incident, however distorted that has become.
So we have a situation where there's the internal politics of Germany. Merkel's approval rating has gone down in the last year, considerably down by, I think, maybe 30%. Inside of Turkey, Erdogan's also facing political isolation. He's sacked, I guess, or forced out the prime minister, Davutoglu. There's now a new prime minister who is officially the head of state, even though Erdogan, as the president, is really running the show in Turkey. Erdogan has been suppressing journalists. He's sending journalists and maybe now parliamentarians who oppose him to prison, getting rid of immunity to send them to trial. How does this play for Erdogan? You have the German government. Of course, Germany and the Ottoman Empire were in unity, in alliance with each other in 1915 when the genocide was carried out by the old Ottoman Empire against Armenian people in the eastern part of Turkey. Why does Erdogan assume the burden and the responsibility for this historical fact? In other words, why the violent reaction against it? And how will it play inside of Turkey? Will it create sort of a nationalist backlash against Germany by Turks, by non-Armenian Turks, in a way that might actually be beneficial to Erdogan?
Well, I mean, this whole issue with the Armenian genocide, it predates Erdogan. And it goes right back, obviously, to the disintegration of the Ottoman Empire. I mean, even though Kemal Atatürk, the person who set up the modern Turkish Republic, was very much opposed to the Ottomans, he detested them. He had this slogan of one nation, one people, and this obviously led to the oppression of Kurds and indeed other minorities within Turkey. The languages were suppressed. Everyone was supposed to speak Turkish. So this the formation of the modern Turkish state is a very a nationalist creation, essentially. So this has everything to do with nationalism and nationalist pride. I mean, and certainly, I was outside the Bundestag, outside the Berlin Gate, where a huge number of people from the Turkish diaspora from across Berlin and even beyond had descended to reject this claim of the Armenian genocide, which there is no doubt happened. There's I mean, all you have to do is go to the deserts in the former Ottoman Empire and in Turkey. In fact, as Robert Fisk has written about extensively, to find the bodies and which are still lingering there. So yeah, it is the main character behind this sort of the ugly character behind this is essentially nationalism, and Erdogan himself is very, very much a despite being I guess almost seeing himself as better, some would say that's the opinion generally, seeing himself as better than Ataturk, trying to outdo Ataturk. He is still a nationalist, and this is the thing that unites them.
Yeah, so Erdogan is an Islamicist. His political party, the AKP party, is an Islamic party. Ataturk, of course, was a secularist, a militant secularist, trying to separate church or mosque from state and to have the two be completely independent. But as you said, Ataturk was also the embodiment of Turkish nationalism, meaning rejecting even the concept that Kurds or Armenians or any other minority peoples exist, if I'm saying it correctly. So here we have the German parliament, and of course Germany is the dominant power in the EU. The EU has rejected Turkey's aspirations to become part of the EU. They're brokering a deal with the Turkish government to stem the tide, to reduce the tide of refugees coming into European countries and into Germany, or maybe the better way of saying it is selecting those refugees who are beneficial to the German economy and rejecting those who are perhaps less educated or less skilled. In other words, looking at human beings as in a trafficking kind of way, in other words. So there's this kind of nationalism within Germany. There's a nationalism within Turkey. There's perhaps a nationalism within the Armenian population. And yet we have this triggering of a new conflict, which seems to be harmful, at least, or detrimental to what the German government has been trying to achieve in its relationship with Turkey. I'm wondering, William Whiteman, does this help isolate Erdogan internationally, or does it at the same time, and maybe the two go together, at the same time bolster his support inside of Turkey? Because what you're saying is that the Turkish population, the 2.7 million Turks who live in Germany, they seem to be rallying behind Turkey on a nationalist basis against the German Bundestag's resolution regarding the Armenian genocide.
I've been to Turkey on several occasions, and whilst there are a huge amount of people within Turkey who are opposed to Erdogan, specifically once you go out of the cities like Ankara and Istanbul and obviously the Kurdish regions, he is incredibly, incredibly popular. So, of course, if you look at it from this perspective, this kind of sort of attempting to strong arm other nations and you know, really trying to assert Turkey, trying to assert itself as a modern day superpower, as it were, under Erdogan, is certainly looked upon by, I would say, a large percentage of the Turkish population as being a positive thing. And like I said, don't get me wrong, there are huge, there's a very, very progressive movement within Turkey, and a lot of people are appalled by what's happening. But so for within Turkey, I would say that it's kind of proving to be a popular thing, and as well amongst the diaspora as well, as I saw in Berlin, well, amongst certain aspects of the diaspora. But obviously, this kind of flagrant nationalism, of course, on a global stage, it doesn't ever do very well. And so this is certainly isolating Turkey with regards to the rest of the world, especially with Europe, which Turkey is so eager to join. I mean, this can only make things worse in terms of them hoping to achieve a membership of the European Union.
Right. So in terms of, let's talk about the German politics. The left party has pushed this forward. Is it because of a desire to bring down Merkel, or is it just ideological, or is it against Turkey for other reasons? I mean, why did they do it? I mean, obviously they were going to do it a year ago, which would have been the centennial, the 100th anniversary. Merkel, as you're saying, delayed that vote perhaps through maneuver, trying to avoid a rift with Turkey. But here it is a year later. It's been passed now. All but one member of the Bundestag voted for it. What's the motivation of the left party and the Green Party in terms of pushing this forward?
Well, I mean, if you look at the outcome of the vote, it's not just the Linke, the Left Party, and the Green Party. This was a pretty much a unanimous vote. There was one person who voted against and one person who abstained, and everyone else voted in favor of it. Particularly in Germany, given, as I said before, given what happened in the Holocaust, there is generally a sort of mindset to try and counter these things. Obviously, I mean, we can say this is like 101 years later. It's very late to recognize it. But if you take into consideration the fact that so far, like only around 20 countries have actually recognized the Armenian genocide, which has pretty much been historically proven to have taken place. If you look at how many countries have also recognized the Holocaust, it's quite staggering. There are a lot of other countries that need to recognize it as well. So this has been something that's been a long, long time coming, and something that's really needed to happen. And as I was saying before, it's just it comes at a bad time for Germany, especially for Angela Merkel's leadership, because they're really trying to get this migration deal to hold together with Turkey because of how catastrophic that would be for her popularity in Germany if it falls apart.
Well, the world went to war 100 years ago and then went to war again 20 years later in 1940. We've been celebrating the end of World War II, but see some of the same organic forms and political manifestations that actually took the country and the world to war then. We've been joined by William Whiteman. We've been talking about German-Turkish relations after the German Bundestag vote. Of course, this will have a big, big impact possibly on the refugee crisis. William Whiteman, thanks again for joining us. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Foreign ministers meet in Paris for talks aimed at resuming the Middle East peace talks between the Palestinians and the Israelis. But with Netanyahu slamming the French initiative and Israel's government taking a further shift to the right, will the talks actually amount to anything? We are joined from California by Soraya Ulrich. She is an independent political analyst. And we are also joined from California by peace activist and author Miko Peled. He is the author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Welcome, Soraya and Miko.
Thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure to be on the show.
So, Soraya, let's start with you. I mean, Paris is hosting the peace conference to try to broker a resolution between Israel and Palestine. But Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he would not attend the conference unless he had a face-to-face talk with Palestinian Authority leader Mahmoud Abbas. Abbas also said he would reject meeting face-to-face with Netanyahu. So what's going on at the peace conference? Does it have any significance?
Frankly, no. I mean, Israel's never been interested in a political situation. And the fact that we're holding all these peace talks, and we have been doing since the first one in 1949, the Lausanne Conference, and many more thereafter, especially after 1967, kind of tends to remind me of what Desmond Tutu said about the missionaries who came to Africa, which was that they had the Bible and we had the land, and they said, let's pray, and we closed our eyes, and they had the land and we were holding the Bible. And the same thing is true of these peace talks. Nothing ever comes out of them. It tends to buy Israel time to further occupy Palestinian land and to increment its incremental genocide. I mean, you know, all these rounds are just buying more and more time. The Palestinian land is shrinking, and so is the number of the Palestinian people. So really, if one is very serious about establishing peace, then one has to do more than just talk or hold talks. One must put in some action, and the parties that are invited to these talks are not willing to do that.
Miko, the Palestinian-Canadian lawyer and former PLO negotiator Diana Butu claims the main issue, holding Israel accountable, is not even on the agenda at the Paris conference. Why won't the conference address holding the state of Israel accountable for human rights abuses against the Palestinians or the continued occupation of lands that Israel seized in 1967, now for almost a half a century ago, that have been condemned by the United Nations in multiple resolutions? Why no accountability?
Well, let me reframe the conversation, if I may, for just a second. So I believe that the only way to move forward is to recognize the following. Palestine was occupied in 1948, and a racist apartheid regime, which is known as the State of Israel, was established in Palestine in 1948, on most of occupied Palestine. In 1967, the State of Israel completed the occupation of Palestine by taking a few small parts that it left out in originally, which were the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and by doing that, completed the occupation of what they call the Land of Israel. We know it's Palestine. And the establishment of a single state with exclusive rights for Jewish people has been in place ever since, and that is it. This idea that there is a Palestine that is different from Israel, and Israel that is different from Palestine, that somehow the State of Israel will negotiate with some Palestinian entity for some kind of a compromise within this framework, is absolutely ludicrous. It is hallucination. It is science fiction. The only way to move forward is a complete condemnation of the racist colonialist project, which is called the State of Israel, and to get rid of it just like apartheid was done away with in South Africa, and replace it with a democracy with equal rights, where Palestinians have all of their rights, where the right of return is materialized, and this whole racist colonialist project is done away with. That is the only way forward, if we're really looking for peace. All of these attempts at peace talks lead to nowhere, because you cannot end a racist colonialist project through peace talks. You can only end it through resistance. So boycott, divestment, sanctions, isolation, all the same techniques that were used to bring down apartheid have to be brought to bear here in order to free all of Palestine, to free the Palestinian people, to free the people in Gaza, to free the Palestinian refugees, allow them to return, to free the political prisoners, and in a way to free Israelis too, who, like the whites in South Africa, are, you know, now they're part of the landscape, although they're not from there, they don't belong there, but this is now the reality, and to free them too from living in this insane ghetto that they created.
Saraya Ulrich, what do you think? I mean, Mika was saying, really, there's not even the foundational or organic possibility of an agreement that brings any sort of justice to the Palestinians, either through the Paris talks or through any of the other myriad and sequential talks that have taken place and might take place in the future after the current negotiations. How do you view it?
Well, he's absolutely right. And there is no question in my mind that there is no will to change the status quo. Because if you look at it, Europe, the Europeans, the EU and the Israelis, their trade has simply grown over the years. Now, if you are the firm belief that there needs to be a two-state solution, which personally I'm opposed to, I think there should be just one democratic state. But if you are opposed to this occupation, then you would seize your trade. You don't allow it to grow. The United States has been funding this occupation and this growth. So what they're doing, the Europeans and the Americans, they're giving lip service, and in a sense is simply public diplomacy or propaganda, if you will, to tell the rest of the world, yes, we are concerned about what has befallen the Palestinians, and we care about Israel, of course. We're trying to remedy this situation, which is absolutely false. They're selling a false truth, a false hope, to the people around the world, and it actually, in a sense, enables them to use human rights as a tool, because then they can intervene in other countries based on the lies of human rights while they're allowing or enabling the genocide of the Palestinians and the occupation. So we, the world at large, is being lied to. There is no there is no reality to these peace talks. They're just, as I mentioned before, buying time for Palestine to be wiped off the map, which Google incidentally did in one instance. As I agree with Mika 100%, that what brought down the apartheid regime in South Africa was in fact BDS, and of course the demise of the Soviet Union at the time, the two together. But it is up to the individuals not to believe what the governments are telling them, not to believe in these peace talks, and take the initiative to remedy this ill, this plague that has befallen the Palestinians.
Well, Amiko and Saraya, I want to ask you two questions, and you can both take a shot at them. One is, are there any differences amongst the Western powers regarding the initiative, the Paris peace talks. In other words, is the French government, for its own reasons, taking a position that's somewhat different from Washington? That's one question. Of course, we have the Israeli, the Netanyahu government slamming the French initiative. So I want you to just speak about that briefly. But I want to ask you if you're talking in an existential way about how the Palestinian issue finally gets resolved. Biko, you were saying BDS. Soraya was agreeing with you that the boycott, divest, sanctions of the Israeli regime, like the apartheid racist government in the 1980s, but also going on in the 1980s and before that in the late 1970s, was an armed struggle by the ANC and other national liberation movements in the southern part of Africa. And of course, then the decisive defeat of the South African military in Angola with the combination of MPLA, Angolan Liberation Army soldiers, and tens of thousands of Cuban fighters who joining with them. In other words, it wasn't just BDS. It was also a part of an armed struggle. So talk about the imperative part of that, if there is one, in the case of justice for the Palestinian people against what you describe, and I agree with you, an apartheid government in Tel Aviv.
Well, I think all of the peace talk attempts are, to say that they're the height of hypocrisy is an understatement. There's been a genocide going on in Palestine. And if we look at the definition of genocide, as it is defined in the Geneva Convention, Article 2, that is the absolute best description of what Israel has been doing to the Palestinians. They've been destroying them, killing them, destroying their culture, destroying their land.
Miko, for our audience, just give what that definition is, and succinctly, in fact, the internationally accepted definition of genocide.
It's the destruction of a people, basically, through the killing, through destruction of their culture, through destruction of their land, and so forth, through incarceration, political, and so forth. So, that's what Israel has been engaged. Israel has been engaged in that to try to bring. Can you imagine trying to convince the French to negotiate with Germans during the German occupation and saying, well, during World War II, this is just a German-French conflict, and that France is disputed territory. It's an absurd proposition. The genocide is to end. And the only way the genocide can end is bringing down the state of Israel and replacing it with a democracy. That is the only way to do that. So this whole idea of having peace talks while the crime is still being committed, as we speak, thousands of political prisoners, the situation in Gaza is horrendous. Palestinians who are Israeli citizens living under racist laws and governed by the Israeli secret police. This is a reality that people absolutely refuse, I don't know if they refuse, but ignore or refuse to talk about. So that is, I think, in terms of any regard for the peace talks, I think that has to be made absolutely clear. Now, obviously, it's never one thing that brings down the regime. BDS is one important aspect. Here in the United States, there are groups on campuses like Students for Justice in Palestine, and they have raised the debate on campuses here in the United States over the last 5-6 years in a way that nobody could have anticipated. This issue of Palestine is being debated and discussed at a level that, again, is remarkable. And again, it's only thanks to these young students on campuses. And the Students for Justice in Palestine phenomenon is growing very rapidly all over campus, all over the United States and in Canada. We also have peace and justice groups. I was just in Europe and giving several talks. The audiences, before, if you spoke about Palestine, especially from an anti-Zionist perspective like mine, you got, 30, 40 people in the audience. That's no longer the case. The audiences are big. The press is interested. People are discussing this. Several courageous politicians are willing to participate as well, members of parliament and so forth. So there is change, and it is like a Parthenon. What brings down a regime is always a combination of things. We know that Israel, the Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon ended only because of the armed resistance of Hezbollah. And we know that when Israel was attacking and invaded and bombed Gaza in 2014, young Palestinians fought very bravely and caused many casualties, which forced the Israeli forces to somewhat withdraw. So, there is that aspect of it as well. But I think the main resistance in Palestine is the BDS movement, and it's the unarmed popular resistance, which is gaining a lot of respect and a lot of momentum everywhere. So those are the elements, and one of them eventually will tip the scales.
I hear you. Let's turn it back to Soraya Ulrich. Soraya, both of you and Miko are talking about the fact that the organic or foundational existence of the state of Israel was based on the theft of Palestinian land, the dispossession of Palestinians from their land. That since that time, there's been an attempt to make the Palestinian people kind of go away through brute force, through exile, all of the things that we know about. And yet, even though there's a constancy to that, there are changes taking place. And inside of the Israeli body politic, it seems to be going in a more and more right-wing and more militarist and more racist direction explicitly. Now you have Lieberman, the right-wing Lieberman, who is essentially declaring war at all times explicitly against Palestinian and Arab and Muslim peoples. He's now the defense minister. Talk about how your evaluation of where things are going inside the state of Israel, because ultimately, large parts of the Israeli population may feel very, very uncomfortable with the political direction of the country's leaders. We have about 2 minutes, so you might have the last word on this.
That's very true. But basically, we're seeing Israel as always has been. I mean, Lieberman is not, he just manifests what Israel has always been about. And in 1997, a United Air Force colonel by the name of Farr wrote a piece. It was a very awakening piece about how Israel was becoming so right-wing and the right-wing was infiltrating the army and how it was becoming a scenario that would be very difficult for the world to handle. He had predicted that in 1997, he wrote about it, and we see it happening, and we're seeing it happening because America enables it. Why is it that the United States has built a site called 9/11 site in Israel that is nuclear-proof? That is Armageddon proof, basically. So America is aware of this, and America has helped it all along, as have the Europeans. And then we can't pretend to be surprised by what's happening. Now the Israelis are being very bold in what they've always planned, which is the total occupation of Palestinian land and beyond. They've even talked about taking over the Golan, well, they've taken it over, not giving it back. And we the governments that are running our lives are refusing to stop it. So again, as Miko said, and I firmly believe, BDS is the only way to go. It's the people's power versus the powers of the government that are enabling this horrendous, horrific genocide in our names under the pretense of preserving democracy and our ally in the region. So we have to take the initiative. We have to fight for humanity, basically.
Okay, well, that was Soraya Ulrich. We've also been speaking with Miko Peled. He is the author of The General Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. They're both talking about BDS, boycott, divestment, sanction, as the key international element to show support for the Palestinian people. We know that on Tuesday, there's going to be a big primary in California, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton at the AIPAC conference basically declared war against the BDS. She gave a militant speech urging Israeli supporters to sort of drive BDS off college campuses in the United States. Really quite something for a presidential candidate on such an explicit message. Soraya and Miko, we hope to have you back. This, of course, is the ongoing struggle, the ongoing issue in the Middle East and, of course, everywhere. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Nobel Peace Prize winner President Barack Obama addressed the graduating class of the Air Force Academy yesterday. Now in his final year in office, what is the true legacy of President Obama's military and foreign policy? 8 years after he campaigned as an anti-war candidate, or that's what many of the people who voted for him thought. We are joined in studio by political activist and author Eugene Puryear. Welcome back, Eugene.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what did President Obama say? He spoke to the Air Force. It was, I don't know, it sounded kind of, didn't sound like a Nobel Peace Prize talk to me.
It did not sound like a Nobel Peace Prize talk, and certainly I think it just is another example of how that was one of the most misplaced Nobel Peace Prize has ever given, probably the most misplaced to Henry Kissinger, author of genocidal bombing campaigns and mass murdering of all types. But President Obama really gave a pretty straightforward defense of his foreign policy in some ways, obviously defending the moves he's made in Syria, the things that happened in Libya, while admitting some mistakes in Libya that they didn't plan for, quote unquote, the day after, which I thought is really kind of an unbelievable statement in some ways. Like, we went in and we bombed this country. We invaded it. We knew we were going to overthrow the same government it had for 40 years. And we didn't make one single plan for what was going to happen after. After President Obama, when he ran as a, quote unquote, anti-war candidate, was extremely critical of the Bush administration's role in Iraq for exactly the same thing. And then he went on to also give something of a brief, and he's given a similar speech to this, about how the United States cannot become quote-unquote isolationist, which is not actually anything that anyone argues, but the reality is the meme from the Democrats and the Republicans and all the establishment parties is any force or anyone in politics that argues that the massive U.S. military-industrial complex should be, not forget dismantled, like I would argue, but even slightly drawn back, is in fact an quote-unquote isolationist and sort of political tool that is consistently used to build up support for the warmongering U.S. military industrial congressional complex, as President Eisenhower.
President Obama just approved a new military budget, or is about to approve a new military budget, which increases the military budget once again. It's about $610 billion officially within the DOD, the Department of Defense. But when you aggregate all the other pieces of war spending, when you go to the Department of Energy, for instance, and other departments, the total U.S. military budget is about $1 trillion. Now, when President Obama was running in 2008, and of course, when he got the Nobel Peace Prize, like 3 days after he got into office, not really, not literally, but about June 2009, before he really had done anything, the whole persona was he was different from George W. Bush, not because he was a Democrat and not a Republican, not because he was the first black president, as opposed to the Bush team, which was identified with white supremacy and racism, but because people really believed he would be a force for peace. And yet here we are, Eugene Perrier, in Iraq. The president has sent 5,000 troops to Iraq, this time on the pretext of fighting ISIS, sent hundreds of commandos into Syria, and has announced the open-ended bombing campaign of both countries, which he undoubtedly knows and has signaled will be handed off to the next president, whether it's Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders or whoever it is. In other words, Obama seems to have morphed and embraced the Bush-Rumsfeld-Cheney concept of endless war.
Yes, and I think the important thing is he actually did not morph. The reality is that President Obama, his whole critique of the war in Iraq was that it was a quote-unquote dumb war, and that the problem with what was going on in the Bush administration isn't necessarily that they went to war. He said in the Air Force Academy speech that war should be the quote-unquote last resort. It's just the way they went to war was incorrect, or they went to the wrong country, or whatever it was. But he actually was at pains, believe it or not, and I think we find a way to forget all this because the sensationalism of the election, the role of the mass media, he was undoubtedly channeling the intense anger against the Iraq war, against the Afghanistan occupation, which really, I think, as we have seen, has been a sign that people in America are very skeptical of this worldwide military, worldwide policing machine. But, you know, he was very clear from day one that he actually was in favor of war. It was just, it became obscured in the euphoria of the moment, as often happens. And it wasn't like he was out there, I'm going to launch a bunch of wars. So he, in and of himself, was trying to present really a two-faced conception of what his policy was, almost a dog whistle effect, where he was using a lot of anti-war rhetoric, but with, you know, a phrase here or a phrase there, and obviously key conversations with key donors behind the scenes to reassure them he was 100% for it.
So people who believed in peace or wanted the U.S. out of Iraq or wanted the U.S. out of Afghanistan or wanted a peace dividend, did not want to have a fully militarized country, they could listen to Barack Obama and take from his speeches as a campaigner in 2008, hey, he's sounding like he supports a real change. And then, but you're saying that kind of, if you read the speeches carefully or listened carefully, he's also signaling that there wasn't going to be any fundamental, not even radical, but even liberal type shift away from the U.S. Imperial foreign policy.
I think 50 years from now, when the history of Obama's presidency is examined, we will find that he was one of the presidents who was more skilled than any president, I think, since John F. Kennedy at using the language of peace to mask a highly imperialistic warlike agenda. I mean, this is something that If you look at where the way Kennedy came in, it was all about peace, even though he was pushing many warlike policies. And Obama is so good at the nuanced speeches. He did the same thing on the economy, the same thing on healthcare. Like, if you really went to his website, if you dug into all his speeches, you saw that in a lot of ways, what he's done is basically what he said he was going to do. He didn't say he was going to do a whole lot, but he used the rhetoric in such a skillful way that he was able to appear as if he was going to do something. It was a clear political bait and switch. And we have to get rid of all this nonsensical BS fairy tale around Obama being some great, normal, regular change maker. He's a hardcore, hard evaluation politician. I mean, this is a guy who disqualified his own mentor off the ballot when he was running for state senate in Illinois. So ultimately, he is just like all the other people who make it to the presidency, someone who is not afraid to stab backs, lie, cheat, or whatever it takes to get to the top. I mean, there's no other way to become president. And I think this issue of wars is a key example of that bait and switch.
So liberals and many people in the peace movement, and you and I both know as organizers of the anti-war movement in the U.S., that a lot of people wanted to really embrace President Obama in 2008. They did embrace him. Of course, it was historic in one sense that an African-American person could become president in a country where white supremacy and racism had been such a dominant force and such a defining force in the country. But, you know, actually, when you look at what or listen to what he said at the Air Force graduation ceremony yesterday, he said, "Nobody can match America's Air Force. Here's a fact. The United States of America remains the most powerful nation on earth and a force for good." That's the exceptional American exceptionalism stuff. "If you target Americans," President Obama goes on, "we will find you and justice will be done and we will defend our nation." I mean, when he's speaking to a peace crowd, he sounds one way. When he's speaking to the graduating class in the Air Force, he sounds just like George W. Bush.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, to say that it's a force for good, I mean, here is someone who is backing the absolute monarchy in Bahrain, which is murdering and drowning in blood, a mass movement looking for some form of democracy, which America cares they support. They said they oppose the Saudi moves in Yemen. And then the next thing, you know, they're turning around and saying like, "Oh, don't worry. You know, we're going to make sure that you get resupplied." And in the last Israeli war in Gaza, when there was widespread international opprobrium about the deaths of civilians, even from friends of Israel, I'll never forget this huge controversy where they needed a big resupply from the U.S.'s giant forward ammunition dump that sits in Israel. And the Obama administration was at so many pains to say, "Oh, no, don't worry. We'll make sure you have all the weapons and all the bombs you need." I mean, absolute monarchies being supported, wars being supported, the toppling and destruction of regimes. I mean, you had the unbelievable things that are happening now in Libya. He said they didn't plan for the day after. And look at the results from that planning.
But let's talk about Libya, too, because one of the first acts of President Obama when he became president was he named Hillary Clinton his arch foe in the 2008 presidential campaign. Millions, tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars had been spent by the two campaigns competing against each other. There was huge passions aroused amongst Democrats. At the end of the day, Barack Obama wins the nomination, wins the presidency, and then names his arch rival Hillary Clinton to be Secretary of State. And she was the champion. It was she who was the champion of the bombing of Libya. And she was the one demanding the U.S. use the United Nations Resolution 1973, which did not say the United States was going to authorize force to carry out regime change in Libya. They said it was to protect civilians. And so on the basis or the pretext of protecting civilians, President Obama agreed with his hawk Secretary of State Clinton to go to war with NATO. U.S., he said, would lead from behind, which was also BS, bad sociology. And of course, the United States and NATO went to war. They bombed Libya. He says, "Well, we didn't plan for the day after." There wasn't supposed to be a day after because Resolution 1973 said it was to protect civilians, not carry out regime change. But that means that Obama knew and Clinton knew that the whole goal was to carry out regime change in a country in Africa that had the largest oil reserves of the entire continent of Africa. That was the goal from the beginning.
It was absolutely the goal. And whatever you want to say about Gaddafi, you know, beyond just the oil, the Libyan government under Gaddafi was the number one force for independent and multilateral development inside of Africa. I mean, on so many different levels, from developing the Africa Airlines, the first African airline that would fly between a lot of African cities so you didn't have to fly to some colonial capital before you came back, someone who was pushing the international currency, who was funding so many different moves. I mean, you talk about infrastructure in Mali, countries like that, that was purely funded by Libya. You even look at what was happening in Southern Africa, where they were trying to help resolve the issue over the land reform by bringing in some of the former white farmers and saying, okay, give up your land in South Africa, give up your land in Zimbabwe back to the blacks, and we are going to bring you into Libya, give you large tracts of land in formerly desert areas where you can have big farms. So, I mean, playing a major role in African unification, African development, African independence from the ultimate reality of European powers in a state where most of the former French colonies in La Francophonie are still putting their reserves, a percentage of their reserves, in the French National Bank. And ultimately, this has always been from the Reagan administration's just criminal support for apartheid South Africa, from the Kennedy administration making moves against Lumumba. One of the key but never talked about elements of U.S. foreign policy is to keep Africa weak, to keep Africa divided, and to prevent Africa from becoming the base of independent, strong, powerful third world development, because they saw what happened in the Soviet Union, they saw what happened in China, and they know that Africa has tremendous potential to overturn this North-South system of complete global domination by America and Europe, and thus they had to take out Gaddafi.
We're talking to Eugene Puryear. He is the author and political analyst. We're talking about President Obama's legacy. He spoke yesterday before the graduating class in the Air Force Academy. President Obama was the Nobel Peace Prize winner in, I believe, June 2009, or certainly shortly after he became president, before there was much of a record of what he would do as president. We're talking about where President Obama really stands and what his real legacy is. Eugene, I want to ask you this. When President Obama was campaigning in 2008, he was also attacking George W. Bush and Guantanamo, the prison that Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld had turned into the internationally recognized torture center that it is. And he was saying, we're going to close Guantanamo. We're going to get rid of torture as a policy, enhanced interrogation. We're going to shut down black hole prison sites. We're not going to carry out the same kind of war on terror, so to speak. But then President Obama did something that George W. Bush only played with, which was to implement not the capturing of suspected, quote, terrorists, but just eliminating them, killing them, setting up what some Jeremy Scahill and others have written in a recent book, the assassination complex, meaning President Obama became the guy who every week looked at a kill list and decided who was going to live and who was going to die, and that he then sent the message out to drone operators or gave authorization. And that's the new policy of the Nobel Peace Prize winner, Barack Obama. Let's not capture our enemies, so-called. Let's just kill them.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think it's important for people to recognize that the United States government under Barack Obama has reserved the right to assassinate by drone any person on the planet Earth that they deem to be a quote-unquote terrorist threat. And how will you know that this person was a threat? You will never know, because they also have reserved the right for themselves to never tell anyone at all about anything that they do in this drone assassination. And so basically what they've done is created a massive program that sets the precedent for any single person sitting in that West Wing Oval Office chair to kill any single person they want via drone. All they have to say is this person was a terrorist that was not at the time. They have redefined imminent. You and I say imminent, we think it means right away. They redefined the definition of imminent, that if they can just say at some point based on something, an imminent threat can just be someone who says at some point in some way something that could potentially be construed that they may sometime ever in history do something to the United States. They can be deemed someone who's able to be killed. They can kill them with a drone, and that no one can do anything to them. I mean, it's unbelievable Wild West cowboy style lawlessness, including U.S. citizens. And even though they try to claim that they didn't, obviously, that is the case. That is the issue around Anwar al-Awlaki. And you remember that his son, who died in that drone crash, and someone said to Robert Gibbs, the then White House press secretary, well, what do you think about the fact that this teenage child died in this thing? And he said, well, he should have had a different father. So, you know, despite all the rhetoric,
just for our audience, his teenage son was targeted in a later drone strike. I think it came 1 or 2 weeks after his father was targeted. Of course, that means there is no due process. You don't have to, the government does not have to say what you've done. They don't have to prove it. You don't have a right to face your accuser. You don't have your day in court. They decide, the president decides in secret every week when he meets with his advisors, who lives, who dies. I mean, how do you then say, hey, but we're a constitutional democracy. We have protections. We have democratic rights. I mean, the whole concept of due process actually is obliterated. And once you cross that line, Eugene Puryear, which President Obama not only crossed the line, he institutionalized it as best practices for the United States. That kind of aggregated power against any sort of checks or balances on supreme power exercised by the Pentagon or the executive, and of course the Pentagon is part of the executive, no future president's going to give that power back, are they?
No, I mean, absolutely not. And I mean, this really began with Ronald Reagan and Iran-Contra, and it's gone through different presidents, Republican and Democratic. Even in the wake of the Church Committee revelations and all the talk about the imperial presidency, is that these presidents have been accumulating more and more power. We've seen it in the NSA spying, the use of executive orders on so many different levels. And Barack Obama has been no different than George W. Bush. And in fact, Democrats have been saying this. I remember once John Kerry said, when he was in the opposition, as it was, someone said to him a criticism of some of the quote unquote imperial powers Bush had taken. And would you roll some of these back? And John Kerry actually openly said, no, we would not roll these back because, you know, we potentially could use this. And I think the reality is that both sides of the coin, Democrat and Republican, have decided that they want to invest the presidency with extreme, almost absolute power. And the only reason it's not absolute is because they've chosen discretion in how they have used it to make the American people think it can't be used against them. But they have, in fact, set the machinery up in a way that it can be used domestically in a very major sense, and there are a number of plans that exist for that. That's not conspiracy, that's reality here. But ultimately, the legal framework, the political framework, and the actual physical machinery has been created for a completely authoritarian movement in this country.
We've been talking to political analyst and author Eugene Puryear about President Obama's real legacy. He spoke yesterday to the graduating class of the U.S. Air Force. We've been talking about the issue of war and peace during the past 7 years of the Obama administration. We will be back tomorrow. We're out of time right now. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.